wasn't aware of all this yet. I look back now, as Dr. Luce urged me to do, to see exactly what 12-year-old Calliope was feeling, watching the charm bracelets undress in steamy light. Was there a shiver of arousal in her? Did flesh respond beneath goalie pads? I try to remember, but what comes back is only a bundle of emotions. Envy, certainly, but also disdain. Inferiority and superiority at once. Above all, there was panic. In front of me, girls were entering and exiting the showers. The flashes of nakedness were like shouts going off. A year or so earlier, these same girls had been porcelain figurines, gingerly dipping their toes into the disinfectant basin at the public pool. Now they were magnificent creatures, moving through the humid air. I felt like a snorkeler. On I came, kicking my heavy padded legs and gaping through the goalie mask at the fantastic underwater life all around me. Sea anemones sprouted from between my classmates' legs. They came in all colors, black, brown, electric yellow, vivid red. Higher up, their breasts bobbed like jellyfish, softly pulsing, tipped with stinging pink. Everything was waving in the current, feeding on microscopic plankton, growing bigger by the minute. The shy, plump girls were like sea lions, lurking in the depths. The surface of the sea is a mirror, reflecting divergent evolutionary paths. Up above, the creatures of air. Down below, those of water. One planet containing two worlds. My classmates were as unastonished by their extravagant traits as a blowfish is by its quills. They seemed to be a different species. It was as if they had scent glands or marsupial pouches, adaptations for fecundity, for procreating in the wild, which had nothing to do with skinny, hairless, domesticated me. I hurried by, desolate, my ears ringing with the noise of the place. Beyond the charm bracelets, I passed next into the area of the kilt pins. The most populous phylum in our locker room, the kilt pins, took up three rows of lockers. There they were, fat and skinny, pale and freckled, clumsily putting on socks or pulling up unbecoming underwear. They were, like the devices that held our tartans together, unremarkable, dull, but necessary in their way. I don't remember any of their names. Past the charm bracelets, through the kilt pins, deeper into the locker room, Calliope limped. Back to where the tiles were cracked and the plaster yellowing, under the flickering light fixtures, by the drinking fountain with the prehistoric piece of gum in the drain, I hurried to where I belonged, to my niche of the local habitat. I wasn't alone that year in having my circumstances altered. The specter of busing had started other parents looking into private schools. Baker and Inglis, with an impressive physical plant but a small endowment, wasn't averse to increasing enrollment. And so, in the autumn of 1972, we had arrived. The steam thins out this far from the showers, and I can see my old friends clearly, Rita Kachuraswamy, with her enormous yellow eyes and sparrow's waist, and Joanne Maria Barbara Paraccio, with her corrected club foot, and, it must be admitted, John Birch Society affiliation. Norma Abdow, whose father had gone away on the Hajj and never come back. Tina Kubek, who was Czech by blood, and Linda Ramirez, half Spanish, half Filipina, who was standing still, waiting for her glasses to unfog. Ethnic girls, we were called. But then who wasn't, when you got right down to it? Weren't the charm bracelets every bit as ethnic? Weren't they as full of strange rituals and food of tribal speech? They said bogue for repulsive and queer for weird. They ate tiny, crustless sandwiches on white bread, cucumber sandwiches, mayonnaise, and something called watercress. Until we came to Baker and Inglis, my friends and I had always felt completely American. But now the bracelets' upturned noses suggested that there was another America to which we could never gain admittance. All of a sudden, America wasn't about hamburgers and hot rods anymore. It was about the Mayflower and Plymouth Rock. It was about something that had happened for 2 minutes 400 years ago instead of everything that had happened since. Instead of everything that was happening now. Suffice it to say that in seventh grade, Calliope found herself aligned with, taken in by, nurtured, and befriended by the year's newcomers. As I opened my locker, my friend said nothing about my porous goaltending. Instead, Ritika kindly turned the subject to an upcoming math test. Joanne Maria Barbara Paraccio slowly peeled off a knee sock. Correctional surgery had left her right ankle as thin as a broomstick. The sight of it always made me feel better about myself. Norma Abdow opened her locker, looked in, and shouted, "Gross!" I stalled, unlacing my pads. On either side, my friends, with quick, shivery movements, stripped off their clothes. They wrapped themselves in towels. "You guys," Linda Ramirez asked, "can I borrow some shampoo?" "Only if you're my lunch peon tomorrow." "No way." "Then no shampoo." "Okay, okay." "Okay what?" "Okay, Your Highness." I waited until they left before I undressed. First, I took off my knee socks. I reached under my athletic tunic and pulled down my shorts. After tying a bath towel around my waist, I unbuttoned the shoulder straps of my tunic and pulled it over my head. This left me with the towel and my jersey on. Now came the tricky part. The brassiere I had was size 30AA. It had a tiny rosette between the cups and a label that read, "Young Miss by Olga." Tessie had urged me to get an old-fashioned training bra, but I wanted something that looked like what my friends had, and preferably padded. I now fastened this item around my waist, clasps in front, and then rotated it into position. At that point, one sleeve at a time, I pulled my arms inside my jersey so that it sat on my shoulders like a cloak. Working inside it, I slid the bra up my torso until I could slip my arms through the armholes. When that was accomplished, I put my kilt on under my towel, removed my jersey, put on my blouse, and tossed the towel away. I wasn't naked for a second. The only witness to my cunning was our school mascot. On the wall behind me, a faded felt banner proclaimed, 1955 State Field Hockey Champions. Below this, striking her customary insouciant pose, was the B&I Wolverette. With her beady eyes, sharp teeth, and tapering snout, she stood leaning on her hockey stick, right foot crossed over left ankle. She wore a blue tunic with a red sash. A red ribbon sat between her furry ears. It was difficult to tell if she was smiling or snarling. There was something of the Yale Bulldog's tenacity in our Wolverette. But there was elegance, too. The Wolverette didn't just play to win. She played to keep her figure. At the nearby drinking fountain, I pressed one finger over the hole, making the water squirt high in the air. I put my head into the stream. Coach Stork always touched our hair before letting us leave, making sure it was wet. The year I was packed off to private school, Chapter 11 went off to college. Although he was safe from the long arm of Judge Roth, other arms had been reaching for him. One hot day the previous July, as I was passing down our upstairs hall, I heard a strange voice emanating from Chapter 11's bedroom. The voice was a man's, and he was reading numbers and dates.
"February 4th, the voice said. 32. February 5th, 321. February 6th.
The accordion door wasn't latched, so I peeked in. My brother was lying on his bed, wrapped in an old afghan Tessie had crocheted for him, his head extended from one end, eyes glazed, and his white legs from the other. Across the room, his stereo amplifier was on, the radio needle jumping. That spring, Chapter 11 had received two letters, one from the University of Michigan informing him of his acceptance, and the other from the U.S. government informing him of his eligibility for the draft. Since then, my apolitical brother had been taking an unusual interest in current events. Every night he watched the news with Milton, tracking military developments and paying close attention to the guarded statements of Henry Kissinger at the Paris peace talks.
"Power is the greatest aphrodisiac," Kissinger famously said, and it must have been true, because Chapter 11 was glued to the set night after night, following the machinations of diplomacy.
At the same time, Milton was pricked by the strange desire of parents, and especially of fathers, to see their children repeat their own sufferings.
"Might do you some good being in the service," he said.
To which Chapter 11 replied,
"I'll go to Canada."
"You will not. If they call you up, you'll serve your country just like I did."
And then Tessie, "Don't worry. The whole thing'll be over before they can get you." In the summer of 72, however, as I watched my number-stunned brother, the war was still officially on. Nixon's Christmas bombings were still awaiting their holiday season. Kissinger was still shuttling between Paris and Washington to maintain his sex appeal. In actuality, the Paris Peace Accords would be signed the following January, and the last American troops would pull out of Vietnam in March. But as I peeked in at my brother's inert body, no one knew that yet. I was aware only of what a strange thing it was to be male. Society discriminated against women, no question. But what about the discrimination of being sent to war? Which sex was really thought to be expendable? I felt a sympathy and protectiveness for my brother I'd never felt before. I thought of Chapter 11, in an army uniform, squatting in the jungle. I imagined him wounded on a stretcher, and I started to cry. The voice on the radio droned on.
February 21st, 141. February 22nd, 74. February 23rd, 206.
I waited until March 20th, Chapter 11's birthday, when the voice announced his draft number. It was 290. He would never go to war. I burst into his room. Chapter 11 leapt out of bed. We looked at each other and, almost unheard of between us, we hugged. The next fall, my brother left not for Canada, but for Ann Arbor. Once again, as when Chapter 11's egg had dropped, I was left alone. Alone at home to note my father's growing anger at the nightly news, his frustration at the half-assed way the Americans were waging the war, napalm notwithstanding, and his increasing sympathy for President Nixon. Alone also to detect a feeling of uselessness that began to plague my mother. With Chapter 11 out of the house and me growing up, Tessie found herself with too much time on her hands. She began to fill her days with classes at the War Memorial Community Center. She learned decoupage. She wove plant hangers. Our house began to fill up with her craft projects. There were painted baskets and beaded curtains, paperweights with various objects suspended in them, dried flowers, colored grains, and beans. She went antiquing and hung an old washboard on the wall. She took yoga, too. It was the combination of Milton's disgust at the anti-war movement and Tessie's sense of uselessness that led them to begin reading the entire 115-volume set of the Great Book Series. Uncle Pete had been touting these books for a long time, not to mention quoting them liberally to score points in Sunday debates. And now, with so much learning in the air, Chapter 11 majoring in engineering, I myself taking first-year Latin with Miss Silber, who wore sunglasses in class, Milton and Tessie decided it was time to round out their education. The great books arrived in 10 boxes stamped with their contents, Aristotle, Plato, and Socrates in one, Cicero, Marcus Aurelius, and Virgil in another. As we shelved the books in the built-in stacks on Middlesex, we read the names, many familiar, Shakespeare, others not, Boethius. Canon bashing wasn't in vogue yet, and besides, the great books began with names not unlike our own, Thucydides, so we felt included.
"Here's a good one," said Milton, holding up Milton.
The only thing that disappointed him was that the series didn't contain a book by Ayn Rand. Nevertheless, that evening after dinner, Milton began reading aloud to Tessie. They went chronologically, starting with Volume 1 and working their way toward 115. While I did my homework in the kitchen, I heard Milton's resonant, drill-like voice saying,
"Socrates, there seem to be two causes of the deterioration of the arts. Adamantus, what are they? Socrates, wealth, I said, and poverty."
When the Plato got to be hard going, Milton suggested skipping ahead to Machiavelli. After a few days of that, Tessie asked for Thomas Hardy, but an hour later, Milton put the book down unimpressed.
"Too many Heaths," he complained. "Heath this and Heath that."
Then they read The Old Man and the Sea by Ernest Hemingway, which they enjoyed, and then they gave the project up. I bring up my parents' failed assault on the great books for a reason. Throughout my formative years, the set remained on our library shelves, weighty and regal-looking with its gold spines. Even back then, the great books were working on me, silently, urging me to pursue the most futile human dream of all, the dream of writing a book worthy of joining their number, a 116th great book with another long Greek name on the cover, Stephanides. That was when I was young and full of grand dreams. Now I've given up any hope of lasting fame or literary perfection. I don't care if I write a great book anymore, but just one which, whatever its flaws, will leave a record of my impossible life. The life which, as I shelved books, was finally revealing itself. Because here is Calliope, opening another carton. Here she is taking out number 45, Locke, Rousseau. Here she is reaching up, without resorting to tiptoes, to put it on the top shelf. And here is Tessie, looking up and saying, "I think you're growing, Cal." It turned out to be an understatement. Beginning in January of seventh grade and continuing into the following August, my previously frozen body underwent a growth spurt of uncommon proportions and unforeseeable consequences. Though at home I was still kept on the Mediterranean diet, the food at my new school, chicken pot pies, tater tots, cube jello, canceled out its fountain of youth effects, and in all ways but one, I began to grow up. I sprouted with the velocity of the mung beans we studied in earth science. Learning about photosynthesis, we kept one tray in the dark and one in the light and measured them every day with metric rulers. Like a mung bean, my body stretched up toward the great grow lamp in the sky, and my case was even more significant because I continued to grow in the dark. At night, my joints ached. I had trouble sleeping. I wrapped my legs in heating pads, smiling through the pain. Because along with my new height, something else was finally happening. Hair was beginning to appear in the required places. Every night, after locking my bedroom door, I angled my desk lamp just so and began to count the hairs. 1 week there were 3, the next 6, 2 weeks later 17. In a grand mood one day, I ran a comb through them. "About time," I said, and even that was different. My voice was beginning to change. It didn't do so overnight. I don't remember any cracking. Instead, my voice began a slow descent that continued for the next couple of years. The ear-splitting quality it had had, which I used as a weapon against my brother, disappeared. Hitting the free in the national anthem was a thing of the past. My mother kept thinking that I had a cold. Sales ladies looked past me for the woman who had asked for help. It was a not unbewitching sound, a mix of flute and bassoon, my consonants slightly slurred, a rush in breathiness to most of my pronouncements. And there were the signs only a linguist could pick up, middle-class elisions, grace notes passed down from Greek into Midwestern twang, the heritage from my grandparents and parents that lived on in me like everything else. I grew tall. My voice matured. But nothing seemed unnatural. My slight build, my thin waist, the smallness of my head, hands, and feet raised no questions in anybody's mind. Many genetic males raised as girls don't blend in so easily. From an early age, they look different, move differently. They can't find shoes or gloves that fit. Other kids call them tomboys, or worse, ape women, gorillas. My skinniness disguised me. The early 70s were a good time to be flat-chested. Androgyny was in. My rickety height and folds legs gave me the posture of a fashion model. My clothes weren't right, my face wasn't right, but my angularity was. I had that Saluki look. Plus, for whatever reason, my dreamy temperament, my bookishness, I fit right in. Still, it wasn't uncommon for certain innocent, excitable girls to respond to my presence in ways they weren't aware of. I'm thinking of Lily Parker, who used to lie down on the lobby couches and rest her head in my lap, looking up and saying, "You have the most perfect chin." Or of June James, who used to pull my hair over her own head so that we could share it like a tent. My body might have released pheromones that affected my schoolmates. How else to explain the way my friends tugged on me, leaned on me? At this early stage, before my male secondary characteristics had manifested themselves, before there were whispers about me in the halls, and girls thought twice about laying their heads in my lap, In seventh grade, when my hair was glossy instead of frizzy, my cheeks still smooth, my muscles undeveloped, and yet invisibly but unmistakably, I began to exude some kind of masculinity. In the way I tossed up and caught my eraser, for instance, or in the way I dive-bombed people's desserts with my spoon, in the intensity of my knit brow or my eagerness to debate anyone on anything in class. When I was a changeling, before I changed, I was quite popular at my new school. But this stage was brief. Soon my headgear lost its nighttime war against the forces of crookedness. Apollo gave in to Dionysus. Beauty may always be a little bit freakish, but the year I turned 13, I was becoming freakier than ever. Consider the yearbook. In the field hockey team photo taken in the fall, I am on one knee in the front row. With my homeroom in the spring, I am stooping in the back. My face is shadowed with self-consciousness. Over the years, my perpetually perplexed expression would drive photographers to distraction. It ruined class photos and Christmas cards until, in the most widely published pictures of me, the problem was finally solved by blocking out my face altogether. If Milton missed having a beautiful daughter, I never knew it. At weddings, he still asked me to dance, regardless of how ridiculous we looked together. "Come on, Kukla," he'd say. "Let's cut the rug." And we'd be off, the squat, plump father, leading with confident, old-fashioned foxtrot steps, and the awkward, praying mantis of a daughter trying to follow along. My parents' love for me didn't diminish with my looks. I think it's fair to say, however, that as my appearance changed in those years, a species of sadness infiltrated my parents' love. They worried that I wouldn't attract boys, that I would be a wallflower like Aunt Zoe. Sometimes when we were dancing, Milton squared his shoulders and looked around the floor as if daring anyone to make a crack. My response to all this growing was to grow my hair. Unlike the rest of me, which seemed bent on doing whatever it wanted, my hair remained under my control. And so, like Desdemona, after her disastrous YWCA makeover, I refused to let anyone cut it. All through seventh grade and into eighth, I pursued my goal. While college students marched against the war, Calliope protested against hair clippers. While bombs were secretly dropped on Cambodia, Callie did what she could do to keep her own secrets. By the spring of 1973, the war was officially over. President Nixon would be out of office in August of the next year. Rock music was giving way to disco. Across the nation, hairstyles were changing. But Calliope's head, like a Midwesterner who always got the fashions late, still thought it was the 60s. My hair, my unbelievably abundant 13-year-old hair. Has there ever existed a head of hair like mine at 13? Did any girl ever summon as many Roto-Rooter men out of their trucks? Monthly, weekly, semi-weekly, the drains in our house clogged.
"Jesus Christ," Milton complained, writing out yet another check. "You're worse than those goddamn tree roots."
Hair. Like a ball of tumbleweed blowing through the rooms of Middlesex. Hair, like a black tornado wheeling across an amateur newsreel. Hair, so vast, it seemed to possess its own weather systems, because my dry split ends crackled with static electricity, whereas closer in, near my scalp, the atmosphere grew warm and moist, like a rainforest. Desdemona's hair was long and silky, but I'd gotten Jimmy Zizmo's spikier variety. Pomade would never subdue it. First ladies would never buy it. It was hair that could turn the Medusa to stone, hair snakier than all the snake pits in a Minotaur movie. My family suffered. My hair turned up in every corner, every drawer, every meal, even in the rice puddings Tessie made, covering each little bowl with wax paper before putting it away in the fridge, even into these prophylactically secure desserts. My hair found its way. Jet black hairs wound themselves around bars of soap. They lay pressed like flower stems between the pages of books. They turned up in eyeglass cases, birthday cards, once, I swear, inside an egg Tessie had just cracked. The next-door neighbor's cat coughed up a hairball one day, and the hair was not the cat's. "That's so gross," Becky Turnbull shouted. "I'm calling the SPCA." In vain, Milton tried to get me to wear one of the paper hats his employees had to wear by law. Tessie, as though I were still six, took a hairbrush to me.
I don't see why you won't let Sophie do something with your hair. Because I see what she does to her hair. Sophie has a perfectly nice hairstyle. Ow! Well, what do you expect? It's a rat's nest. Just leave it. Be still. More brushing, tugging, my head jerking with every stroke. Short hair's the style now, anyway, Callie. Are you finished? A few final frustrated strokes, then plaintively, at least tie it back. Keep it out of your face. What could I tell her? That was the whole point of having long hair, to keep it in my face. Maybe I didn't look like Dorothy Hamill. Maybe I was even starting to bear a strong resemblance to our weeping willow trees. But there were virtues to my hair. It covered tinsel teeth, it covered satirical nose, it hid blemishes, and best of all, it hid me. Cut my hair? Never! I was still growing it out. My dream was someday to live inside it. Imagine me then at unlucky 13 as I entered the 8th grade. 5 feet, 10 inches tall, weighing 131 pounds, black hair hanging like drapes on either side of my nose, people knocking on the air in front of my face and calling out, "Anybody in there?" I was in there all right. Where else could I go? Waxing lyrical. I am back to my old ways, to my solitary walks through Victoria Park, to my Romeo y Julietas, my Davidoff Grand Cru, to my embassy receptions, my Philharmonic concerts, my nightly rounds at the Felsenkeller. It's my favorite time of year, fall. The slight chill to the air, quickening the brain and all the school kid school year memories attached to autumn. You don't get the bright leaves here in Europe the way you do in New England. The leaves smolder but never catch flame. It's still warm enough to bicycle. Last night I rode from Schöneberg to Orienburger Straße in Mitte. I met a friend for a drink. Leaving, riding through the streets, I was hailed by the intergalactic streetwalkers. In their manga suits, their moon boots, they tossed their tease doll's hair and called, "Hello, hello!" Maybe they would be just the thing for me. Remunerated, to tolerate most anything, shocked by nothing. And yet as I pedaled past their lineup, their strick, my feelings toward them were not a man's. I was aware of a good girl's reproachfulness and disdain, along with a perceptible physical empathy. As they shifted their hips, hooking me with their darkly painted eyes, my mind filled not with images of what I might do with them, but with what it must be like for them night after night, hour after hour, to have to do it. The Hurin themselves didn't look too closely at me. They saw my silk scarf, my Zegna pants, my gleaming shoes. They saw the money in my wallet. "Hello," they called. "Hello, hello." It was fall then, too, the fall of 1973. I was only a few months from turning 14, and one Sunday after church, Sophie Sassoon whispered in my ear, "Han, you're getting just the tiniest bit of a mustache. Have your mother bring you by the shop. I'll take care of it for you." A mustache? Was it true? Like Mrs. Drexel? I hurried to the bathroom to see. Mrs. Tsouloris was reapplying lipstick, but as soon as she left, I put my face up to the mirror. Not a full-fledged mustache. Only a few darkish hairs above my upper lip. This wasn't as surprising as it may seem. In fact, I'd been expecting it. Like the Sun Belt or the Bible Belt, there exists on this multifarious earth of ours a hair belt. It begins in southern Spain, congruent with Moorish influence. It extends over the dark-eyed regions of Italy, almost all of Greece, and absolutely all of Turkey. It dips south to include Morocco, Tunisia, Algeria, and Egypt. Continuing on, and darkening color as maps do to indicate ocean depth, it blankets Syria, Iran, and Afghanistan, before lightening gradually in India. After that, except for a single dot representing the Ainu in Japan, the hair belt ends.
Sing, muse of Greek ladies in their battle against unsightly hair. Sing of depilatory creams and tweezers of bleach and beeswax. Sing how the unsightly black fuzz, like the Persian legions of Darius, sweeps over the Achaean mainland of girls barely into their teens. No, Calliope was not surprised by the appearance of a shadow above her upper lip. My Aunt Zoe, my mother, Sor Melina, and even my cousin Cleo all suffered from hair growing where they didn't want it to. When I close my eyes and summon the fond smells of childhood, do I smell gingerbread baking or the pine fresh scent of Christmas trees? Not primarily. The aroma that fills, as it were, the nostrils of my memory is the sulfurous, protein-dissolving fetor of Nair. I see my mother, with her feet in the tub, waiting for the bubbling, stinging foam to work. I see Sor Melina heating up a tin of wax on the stove. The pains they took to make themselves smooth, the rashes the creams left, the futility of it all. The enemy, hair, was invincible. It was life itself. I told my mother to make an appointment for me at Sophie Sassoon's beauty parlor at the Eastland Mall. Wedged between a movie theater and a submarine sandwich shop, the Golden Fleece did what it could to distance itself socially from its neighbors. A tasteful awning hung over the entrance, bearing the silhouette of a Parisian grande dame. Inside, flowers sat on the front desk. Just as colorful as the flowers was Sophie Sassoon herself. In a purple muumuu, braceleted and begemmed, she glided from chair to chair. How we doing here? Oh, you look gorgeous. That color takes 10 years off. Then to the next customer. Don't look so worried, trust me. This is how they're wearing their hair now. Ronaldo, tell her. And Ronaldo in his hip huggers, like Miach Ferro in Rosemary's Baby. Sick flick, but she look great. But then Sophie had moved on to the next person. Hun, let me give you some advice. Don't blow dry your hair. Let it dry wet. Also, I got a conditioner for you. You won't believe. I'm an authorized dealer. It was Sophie Sassoon's personal attention the women came for, the feeling of safety the salon gave them, the assurance that in here they could expose their flaws without embarrassment, and Sophie would take care of them. It must have been the love they came for. Otherwise, the customers would have noticed that Sophie Sassoon was herself in need of beauty advice. They would have seen that her eyebrows were drawn on as though by magic marker, and that her face, owing to the Princess Borghese makeup she sold on commission, was the color of a brick. But did I see it that day myself, or in the weeks that followed? Like everyone else, instead of judging the final effect of Sophie Sassoon's makeup job, I was impressed by the complexity of it. I knew, as did my mother and the other ladies, that to put on her face every morning, it took Sophie Sassoon no less than 1 hour and 45 minutes. She had to apply eye creams and under-eye creams. She had to lay down various layers, like shellacking a Stradivarius. In addition to the brick-colored final coat, there were others. Dabs of green to control redness, pinks to add blush, blues above the eyes. She used dry eyeliner, liquid eyeliner, lip liner, lip conditioner, a frosted highlighter, and a pore minimizer. Sophie Sassoon's face, it was created with the rigor of a sand painting, blown grain by grain by Tibetan monks. It lasted only a day, and then it was gone. This face now said to us, right this way, ladies. Sophie was warm, as always, loving, as always. Her hands, treated every night with vanishing cream, fluttered around us, stroking, rubbing. Her earrings looked like something Schliemann had dug up at Troy. She led us past a line of women having their hair set, across a stifling ghetto of hair dryers, and through a blue curtain. In the front of the Golden Fleece, Sophie fixed people's hair. In the back, she removed it. Behind the blue curtain, half-naked women presented portions of themselves to wax. One large woman was on her back, her blouse pulled up to expose her navel. Another was lying on her stomach, reading a magazine while wax dried on the back of her thighs. There was a woman sitting in a chair, her sideburns and chin smeared with dark golden wax, and there were two beautiful young women lying naked from the waist down, having their bikini lines done. The smell of the beeswax was strong, pleasant. The atmosphere was like a Turkish bath without the heat. A lazy, draped feeling to everything, steam curling off pots of wax. "I'm only having my face done," I told Sophie. "She sounds like she's paying," Sophie joked to my mother. My mother laughed, and the other women joined in. Everyone was looking our way, smiling. I'd come from school and was still in my uniform. "Be glad it's just your face," said one of the bikini liners. "Few years from now," said the other, "you might be heading south." Laughter, winks. Even to my astonishment, a sly smile spreading over my mother's face. As if behind the blue curtain, Tessie was another person. As if now that we were getting waxed together, she could treat me like an adult. "Sophie, maybe you can convince Callie to get her hair cut," Tessie said. "It's a little bushy, hon," Sophie leveled with me, "for your face shape." "Just a wax, please," I said. "She won't listen," said Tessie. A Hungarian woman, from the outskirts of the hair belt, did the honors. With the short order efficiency of Jimmy Papanicolaou, she positioned us around the room like food on a grill. In one corner, the large woman as pink as a slab of Canadian bacon. Down at the bottom, Tessie and me lumped together like home fries. Over on the left, the bikini liners lying sunny side up. Helga kept us all sizzling. Holding her aluminum tray, she moved from body to body, spreading maple syrup-colored wax where it was needed with a flat wooden spoon and pressing in strips of gauze before it hardened. When the large woman was done on one side, Helga flipped her over. Tessie and I lay in our chairs, listening to wax being violently removed. "Oh, my!" cried the large lady. "It's nothing," belittled Helga. "I do it perfect." "Ow-ee!" yelped a bikini liner, and Helga taking an oddly feminist stance. "See what you do for the men's. You suffer. Is not worth it." Now Helga came over to me. She took hold of my chin and moved my head from side to side, examining. She spread wax above my upper lip. She moved to my mother and did the same. 30 seconds later, the wax had hardened. "I have a surprise for you," Tessie said. "What?" I asked as Helga ripped. I was certain my fledgling mustache was gone, also my upper lip. "Your brother's coming home for Christmas." My eyes were tearing. I blinked and said nothing, momentarily dumbfounded. Helga turned to my mother. "Some surprise," I said. "He's bringing a girlfriend." "He's got a girlfriend? Who would go out with him? Her name is..." Helga ripped. After a moment, my mother resumed. "Meg." From then on, Sophie Sassoon took care of my facial hair. I went in about twice a month, adding depilation to an ever-growing list of upkeep requirements. I started shaving my legs and underarms. I plucked my eyebrows. The dress code at my school forbade cosmetics, but on weekends I got to experiment within limits. Ritika and I painted our faces in her bedroom, passing a hand mirror back and forth. I was particularly given to dramatic eyeliner. My model here was Maria Callas, or possibly Barbara Streisand in Funny Girl, the triumphant, long-nosed divas. At home, I snooped in Tessie's bedroom. I loved the amulet-like vials, the sweet-smelling, seemingly edible creams. I tried out her facial steamer, too. You put your face to the plastic cone and were blasted by heat. I stayed away from greasy moisturizers, worried they would make me break out. With Chapter 11 off at college, he was a sophomore now, I had the bathroom to myself. This was evident from the medicine cabinet. Two pink daisy razors stood upright in a small drinking cup next to a spray can of Psst! Instant shampoo. A tube of Dr. Pepper lip smacker, which tasted like the soft drink, kissed a bottle of Gee, your hair smells terrific. My Breck cream rinse with body promised to make me the girl with the hair. But wasn't I already? From there, we move on to the facial products. My EpiClear acne kit, my Crazy Curl hair iron, a bottle of Fem Iron pills, which I was hoping to someday need, and a shaker of Love's Baby Soft body powder. Then there was my aerosol can of soft and dry non-sting antiperspirant and my two bottles of perfume. Wood Hue, a mildly disturbing Christmas present from my brother, which I consequently never wore, and L'Air de Tompe by Nina Ricci. Only the romantic need apply. I also had a tub of Jolene Creme Bleach for between appointments at the Golden Fleece. Interspersed amid these totemic items were stray Q-tips and cotton balls, lip liners, Max Factor eye makeup, mascara, blush, and everything else I used in a losing battle to make myself beautiful. Finally, hidden in the back of the cabinet was the box of Kotex pads, which my mother had given me one day. "We'd better just keep these on hand," she said, astonishing me completely. No further explanation than that. The hug I had given Chapter 11 in the summer of 72 turned out to be a kind of farewell, because when he returned home from college after his freshman year, my brother had become another person. He'd grown his hair out, not as long as mine, but still. He started learning the guitar. Perched on his nose was a pair of granny glasses, and instead of straight legs, he now wore faded bell-bottom jeans. The members of my family have always had a knack for self-transformation. While I finished my first year at Baker & Inglis and began my second, while I went from being a short seventh grader to an alarmingly tall eighth grader, Chapter 11 up at college went from science geek to John Lennon lookalike. He bought a motorcycle. He started meditating. He claimed to understand 2001 A Space Odyssey, even the ending. But it wasn't until Chapter 11 descended into the basement to play ping-pong with Milton that I understood what was behind all this. We'd had a ping-pong table for years, but so far, no matter how much my brother or I practiced, we had never come close to beating Milton. Neither my new long reach nor Chapter 11's beetle-browed concentration was sufficient to counter Milton's wicked spin or his killer shot, which left red marks on our chests through our clothes. But that summer, something was different. When Milton used his extra-fast serve, Chapter 11 returned it with a minimum of effort. When Milton employed the English he'd learned in the Navy, Chapter 11 counterspun. Even when Milton smashed a winner across the table, Chapter 11, with stupendous reflexes, sent it back where it came from. Milton began to sweat. His face turned red. Chapter 11 remained cool. He had a strange, distracted look on his face. His pupils were dilated. "Go!" I cheered him on. "Beat Dad!" 12-12, 12-14, 14-15, 17-18, 18-21. Chapter 11 had done it. He'd beaten Milton. "I'm on acid," he explained later. "What?" "Window pane, three hits." The drug had made everything seem as if it were happening in slow motion. Milton's fastest serves, his most arching spin shots and smashes seemed to float in the air. LSD? Three hits? Chapter 11 had been tripping the whole time. He had been tripping during dinner. "That was the hardest part," he said. "I was watching Dad carve the chicken, and then it flapped its wings and flew away." "What's the matter with that kid?" I heard my father ask my mother through the wall separating our rooms. "Now he's talking about dropping out of engineering? Says it's too boring?" "It's just a stage. It'll pass." "It better." Shortly thereafter, Chapter 11 had returned to college. He hadn't come back for Thanksgiving. And so, as Christmas of 73 approached, we all wondered what he would be like when we saw him again. We quickly found out. As my father had feared, Chapter 11 had scuttled his plans to become an engineer. Now, he informed us, he was majoring in anthropology. As part of an assignment for one of his courses, Chapter 11 conducted what he called field work during most of that vacation. He carried a tape recorder around with him, recording everything we said. He took notes on our ideation systems and rituals of kin bonding. He said almost nothing himself, claiming that he didn't want to influence the findings. Every now and then, however, while observing our extended family eat and joke and argue, Chapter 11 would let out a laugh. A private eureka that made him fall back in his chair and lift his erst shoes off the floor. Then he would lean forward and begin writing madly in his notebook. As I've mentioned, my brother didn't pay much attention to me while we were growing up. That weekend, however, spurred on by his new mania for observation, Chapter 11 took a new interest in me. On Friday afternoon, while I was diligently doing some advance homework at the kitchen table, he came and sat down. He stared at me thoughtfully for a long time.
Latin, huh? That what they're teaching you in that school?
I like it.
You a necrophiliac?
A what?
That's someone who gets off on dead people. Latin's dead, isn't it?
I don't know.
I know some Latin.
You do?
Cunnilingus?
Don't be gross.
Fellatio? Ha ha. Mons veneris? I'm dying of laughter. You're killing me. Look, I'm dead.
Chapter 11 was quiet for a while. I tried to go on studying, but felt him staring at me. Finally exasperated, I closed my book.
What are you looking at? I said.
There was a pause characteristic of my brother. Behind his granny glasses, his eyes looked bland. But the mind behind them was working things out.
I'm looking at my little sister, he said.
Okay, you saw her, now go. I'm looking at my little sister and thinking she doesn't look like my little sister anymore.
What's that supposed to mean, I asked.
Again, the pause.
I don't know, said my brother.
I'm trying to figure it out.
Well, when you figure it out, let me know. Right now, I've got stuff to do.
On Saturday morning, Chapter 11's girlfriend arrived. Meg Zemka was as small as my mother and as flat-chested as me. Her hair was a mousy brown, her teeth, owing to an impoverished childhood, not well cared for. She was a waif, an orphan, a runt, and six times as powerful as my brother.
What are you studying up at college, Meg? My father asked at dinner.
Poli-sci.
That sounds interesting. I doubt you'd like my emphasis. I'm a Marxist.
Oh, you are you?
You run a bunch of restaurants, right?
That's right. Hercules Hot Dogs. Haven't you ever had one? We'll have to take you down to one of our stands.
Meg doesn't eat meat, my mother reminded.
Oh, yeah, I forgot, said Milton.
Well, you can have some French fries. We've got French fries.
What do you pay your workers? Meg asked.
The ones behind the counter, they get minimum wage.
And you live out here in this big house in Grosse Pointe.
That's because I handle the entire business and accept the risk.
Sounds like exploitation to me.
It does it?
Milton smiled.
Well, if giving somebody a job is exploiting them, then I guess I'm an exploiter. Those jobs didn't exist before I started the business.
That's like saying that the slaves didn't have jobs until they built the plantations.
You've got a real live wire here, Milton said, turning to my brother. Where did you find her?
I found him, said Meg, on top of an elevator.
That was when we learned how Chapter 11 was spending his time at college. His favorite pastime was to unscrew the ceiling panel on the dorm elevator and climb up on top. He sat there for hours, riding up and down in the darkness.
The first time I did it, Chapter 11 now confessed, the car started going up to the top. I thought I might get crushed, but they leave some airspace.
This is what we're paying your tuition for? Milton asked.
That's what you're exploiting your workers for, said Meg.
Tessie made Chapter 11 and Meg sleep in separate rooms, but in the middle of the night there was a lot of tiptoeing and giggling in the dark. Trying to be the big sister I never had, Meg gave me a copy of Our Bodies Ourselves. Chapter 11, swept up in the sexual revolution, tried to educate me, too.
You ever masturbate, Cal?
What?
You don't have to be embarrassed. It's natural. This friend of mine told me you could do it with your hand, so I went into the bathroom. I don't want to hear about it. And tried it out. All of a sudden, all the muscles in my penis started contracting.
In our bathroom?
And then I ejaculated. It felt really amazing. You should try it, Cal, if you haven't already. Girls are a little different, but physiologically, it's pretty much the same. I mean, the penis and the clitoris are analogous structures. You gotta experiment to see what works. I put my fingers in my ears and started humming. You don't have to have any hang-ups with me, Chapter 11 said loudly. I'm your brother! The rock music, the reverence for Maharishi Mahesh Yogi, the avocado pits sprouting on the windowsill, the rainbow-colored rolling papers. What else? Oh, yeah, my brother had stopped using deodorant. You stink, I objected one day, sitting next to him in the TV room. Chapter 11 gave the tiniest of shrugs. I'm a human, he said. This is what humans smell like. Then humans stink. Do you think I stink, Meg? No way, nuzzling up to his armpit. It turns me on. Will you guys get out of here? I'm trying to watch this show. Hey, baby, my little sister wants us to split. What do you say to a little nookie? Groovy. See you, sis. We'll be upstairs in flagrante delecto. Where could all this lead? Only to family dissension, shouting matches, and heartbreak. On New Year's Eve, as Milton and Tessie toasted the New Year with glasses of cold duck, Chapter 11 and Meg swigged on bottles of elephant malt liquor, going outside every so often to secretly smoke a joint. Milton said, You know, I've been thinking about finally making that trip to the old country. We could go back and see Papu and Yaya's village. And fix that church like you promised, said Tessie. What do you think? Milton asked Chapter 11. Maybe we could take a family vacation this summer. Not me, said Chapter 11. Why not? Tourism is just another form of colonialism. And so on and so forth. Before long, Chapter 11 declared that he didn't share Milton and Tessie's values. Milton asked what was wrong with their values. Chapter 11 said he was against materialism. All you care about is money, he told Milton. I don't want to live like this, he gestured toward the room. Chapter 11 was against our living room, everything we had, everything Milton had worked for. He was against Middlesex. Then shouting, and Chapter 11 uttering two words to Milton, one beginning with F, the other with Y, and more shouting, and Chapter 11's motorcycle roaring away with Meg on the back. What had happened to Chapter 11? Why had he changed so much? It was being away from home, Tessie said. It was the times. It was all this trouble with the war. I, however, have a different answer. I suspect that Chapter 11's transformation was caused, in no small part, by that day on his bed when his life was decided by lottery. Am I projecting? Saddling my brother with my own obsessions, with chance and fate? Maybe. But as we planned a trip that had been promised when Milton was saved from another war, it appeared that Chapter 11, taking chemical trips of his own, was trying to escape what he had dimly perceived while wrapped in an Afghan. The possibility that not only his draft number was decided by lottery, but that everything was. Chapter 11 was hiding from this discovery. Hiding behind windowpane, hiding on top of elevators, hiding in the bed of Meg Zemka with her multiple O's and bad teeth. Meg Zemka, who hissed in his ear while they made love, Forget your family, man. Oh, they're bourgeois pigs. Your dad's an exploiter, man. Forget 'em. They're dead, man. This is what's real, right here. Come and get it, baby. The Obscure Object. It occurred to me today that I'm not as far along as I thought. Writing my story isn't the courageous act of liberation I had hoped it would be. Writing is solitary, furtive. And I know all about those things. I'm an expert in the underground life. Is it really my apolitical temperament that makes me keep my distance from the intersexual rights movement? Couldn't it also be fear of standing up, of becoming one of them? Still, you can only do what you're able. If this story is written only for myself, then so be it. But it doesn't feel that way. I feel you out there, reader. This is the only kind of intimacy I'm comfortable with. Just the two of us here in the dark. Things weren't always like this. In college, I had a girlfriend. Her name was Olivia. We were drawn together by our common woundedness. Olivia had been savagely attacked when she was only 13, nearly raped. The police had caught the guy who did it, and Olivia had testified in court numerous times. The ordeal had arrested her development. Instead of doing the normal things a high school girl did, she had had to remain that 13-year-old girl on the witness stand. While Olivia and I were both intellectually capable of handling the college curriculum, of excelling in it even, we remained in key ways emotionally adolescent. We cried a lot in bed. I remember the first time we took off our clothes in front of each other. It was like unwinding bandages. I was as much a man as Olivia could bear at that point. I was her starter kit. After college, I took a trip around the world. I tried to get my body by keeping it in motion. 9 months later, back home, I took the Foreign Service exam, and a year after that started working for the State Department. A perfect job for me. 3 years in one place, two in another, never long enough to form a solid attachment to anyone. In Brussels, I fell in love with a bartender who claimed not to care about the uncommon way I was made. I was so grateful that I asked her to marry me, though I found her dull company, ambitionless, too much of a shouter, a hitter. Fortunately, she refused my proposal and ran off with someone else. Who has there been since? A few here and there, never long-lasting. And so, without permanence, I have fallen into the routine of my incomplete seductions. The chatting up I'm good at, the dinners and drinks, the clinches in doorways, but then I'm off. I've got a meeting with the ambassador in the morning, I say, and they believe me. They believe the ambassador wants to be briefed on the upcoming Aaron Copland tribute. It's getting harder all the time. With Olivia and every woman who came after her, there has been this knowledge to deal with, the great fact of my condition. The obscure object and I met unawares, however, in blissful ignorance. After all the screaming in our house, there reigned that winter on Middlesex only silence. A silence so profound that, like the left foot of the president's secretary, it erased portions of the official record. A soggy, evasive season during which Milton, unable to admit the Chapter 11's attack, had broken his heart, began visibly to swell with rage so that almost anything set him off. A long red light, ice milk for dessert instead of ice cream. His was a loud silence, but a silence nonetheless. A winter during which Tessie's worries about her children immobilized her, so that she failed to return Christmas presents that didn't fit and merely put them in the closet without getting a refund. At the end of this wounded, dishonest season, as the first crocuses appeared, returning from their winter in the underworld, Calliope Stephanides, who also felt something stirring in the soil of her being, found herself reading the classics. Spring semester of 8th grade brought me into Mr. De Silva's English class. A group of only 5 students, we met in the greenhouse on the 2nd floor. Spider plants let down vines from the glass roof. Closer to our heads, geraniums crowded in, giving off a smell somewhere between licorice and aluminum. In addition to me, there was Riedeke, Tina, Joanne, and Maxine Grossinger. Though our parents were friends, I hardly knew Maxine. She didn't mix with the other kids on Middlesex. She was always practicing her violin. She was the only Jewish kid at school. She ate lunch alone, spooning kosher food from Tupperware. I assumed her pallor was the result of being indoors all the time, and that the blue vein that beat wildly at her temple was a kind of inner metronome. Mr. De Silva had been born in Brazil. This was hard to notice. He wasn't exactly the carnival type. The Latin details of his childhood, the hammock, the outdoor tub, had been erased by a North American education and a love of the European novel. Now he was a liberal Democrat and wore black armbands in support of radical causes. He taught Sunday school at a local Episcopal church. He had a pink, cultivated face and dark blonde hair that fell into his eyes when he recited poetry. Sometimes he picked thistles or wild flowers from the green and wore them in the lapel of his jacket. He had a short, compact body and often did isometric exercises between class periods. He played the recorder, too. A music stand in his classroom held sheet music, early Baroque pieces mostly. He was a great teacher, Mr. De Silva. He treated us with complete seriousness, as if we eighth graders, during fifth period, might settle something scholars had been arguing about for centuries. He listened to our chirping, his hairline pressing down on his eyes. When he spoke himself, it was in complete paragraphs. If you listened closely, it was possible to hear the dashes and commas in his speech, even the colons and semicolons. Mr. De Silva had a relevant quotation for everything that happened to him, and in this way evaded real life. Instead of eating his lunch, he told you what Oblonsky and Levin had for lunch in Anna Karenina. Or describing a sunset from Daniel Deranda, he failed to notice the one that was presently falling over Michigan. Mr. De Silva had spent a summer in Greece 6 years before. He was still keyed up about it. When he described visiting the Mani, his voice became even mellower than usual and his